From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the history of how the European countries divided up Africa and claimed it for themselves. We talk with Thomas Pakenham, author of the new book, The Scramble for Africa. Did you know that before World War I, little boys were supposed to wear pink, little girls blue? That's one of the things Marjorie Garber shares in her new study of cross-dressing. Coming up, we talk about how cross-dressing challenges our assumptions about gender. World music commentator Milo Miles listens to Haiti's pop music, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews JFK. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. New York Governor Mario Cuomo announced late this afternoon that he would not file papers to enter the New Hampshire primary and that he would not run for president in 1992. Karen DeWitt of New York Public Radio reports.
Governor Mario Cuomo says what prevented him from entering the 1992 presidential race is failure to reach agreement with Republicans in state government on the state's massive budget problems.
It would simply be an ugly contradiction for me to cause damage to the people of the state I swore to serve, telling them all the while that I was on a greater mission to preserve them in the future by fighting my way to Washington.
Cuomo says while he could theoretically still enter the race at a later date, Democratic Party Chair Ron Brown has told him it would be better not to. Cuomo had enticed reporters and political observers with his weeks of public ruminations over whether he would challenge George Bush. Now the speculation has ended. For National Public Radio, I'm Karen DeWitt in Albany.
A federal judge in Miami has ruled that the United States cannot repatriate more than 8,000 Haitian refugees until they have a chance to speak with their lawyers. District Judge Clyde Atkins said that the ban would further the government's interest in assuring that no political refugee was wrongfully repatriated. Atkins has twice prevented the government from sending the Haitians home and has twice been overruled on appeal. The Bush administration says that most of the boat people fled their country for economic rather than political reasons and thus are not eligible for asylum. In Moscow, the Russian government continued to work quickly to assume control of what remains of the old Central Soviet power bloc. The moves have left the Soviet-style bureaucracy reeling. More from the BBC's Bridget Kendall in Moscow.
This morning, Soviet officials in the Kremlin and the foreign ministry were reeling from reports their jobs had effectively been abolished overnight. This afternoon came news of a further Russian takeover, this time of the Central Foreign Intelligence Service, the Soviet equivalent to the CIA, headed by Yevgeny Primakov and set up by President Gorbachev only a few months ago. This now means all the main arms of the former Soviet central government are, or soon will be, in President Yeltsin's hands. The only exceptions are the Soviet Defense Ministry and Ministry for Atomic Energy. Their future will no doubt be negotiated between republics at the new Commonwealth meeting in Almaty this weekend.
The BBC's Bridget Kendall. Stock prices were up sharply today in response to the Federal Reserve's 1% cut in the discount rate, a bolder move than most analysts had been expecting. Even without the news, trading was extra heavy today because of the quarterly triple witching hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 20 points to finish the day at 2,934.48. Advances led to declines by a margin of 2-1. This is NPR. Major banks began responding to the Federal Reserve's cuts in interest rates today by lowering their prime rates, the interest they charge their best commercial customers. Morgan Guaranty Trust of New York, the nation's fourth largest bank, cut its prime rate a full percent, from 7.5 to 6.5. Other major banks were expected to follow suit. As President Bush gets ready for his 10-day trade mission to Asia, members of Congress unveiled legislation today aimed at reducing Japan's $41 billion trade advantage. The bill would force Japan to open its markets or face cuts in its auto exports to the United States. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Trade issues will be center stage next month when President Bush heads to Tokyo. Today, several members of Congress, largely from car manufacturing states, gave the president some indication of what they expect. The group of Democrats unveiled a bill that they say will be introduced if the president is unsuccessful in persuading Japan to open its markets. Michigan Senator Donald Riegel.
While Japan floods the U.S. market with excess Japanese production, they systematically block American goods from being sold openly and fairly in Japan.
U.S. cars and trucks make up 1% of the Japanese market. Today, lawmakers blame the current economic downturn on the trade imbalance. Michigan's John Dingell said the recession was in part made in Japan. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Commerce Department ruled today that top Japanese automakers have been selling minivans at artificially low prices in the United States to undermine American competitors. The preliminary ruling said that Toyota, Mazda, and other Japanese automakers have been dumping their minivans at prices ranging from 1 to 7% less than they charge in Japan. The ruling came at the request of the big three American automakers, which have reported record losses this year. The decision means the government will now impose duties on the minivans. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The story of contemporary Africa has too often been the story of dictatorship, civil war, famine, and poverty. To understand why, it helps to go back to the history of colonial Africa, when European countries carved up the continent and ruled over it. This is the subject of Thomas Pakenham's new book, The Scramble for Africa. The book begins in 1876, the year explorer Henry Stanley traveled down the Congo River, opening up Central Africa to Europe. It was also the year King Leopold of Belgium decided to create an African empire for himself. He engaged Stanley to open up Belgian trading stations along the river. In 1885, Leopold named himself King of the Congo. Pakenham says the story of the Congo, its exploration and colonization, is the backbone of the larger story of Africa's colonization.
The middle of Africa was unknown and not just uncolonized, and the explorers were beginning to open up the secrets. And the last secret was the identity of this huge river, which had been discovered by David Livingstone, who was an explorer as well as a missionary. And the question was it the Nile leading northwards back to the Mediterranean and therefore a way into Central Africa from the Mediterranean, or was it the Congo and leading westwards and therefore a way into Africa from the Atlantic, from the west? And the man who answered that question was Stanley, explorer, and he was he proved that it was the Congo, and as soon as he arrived back in Europe, King Leopold of the Belgians commissioned Stanley to take over the Congo for himself. And I say for himself, not for Belgium, it's very important, but for himself as an entrepreneur, as a personal business enterprise. And so the Congo, from right beginning, from 1876, and the arrival of Stanley after discovering the river in 1878, becomes the main focus, really, for exploration of Central Africa.
You say that the Congo wasn't a colony as much as it was King Leopold of Belgium's personal state.
It wasn't a national colony, it was a personal colony. In fact, it's the most extraordinary anomaly that one man could take over a huge chunk of Africa in his own name. And he called it the Congo Free State. Free State. I mean, that's an amazing, ironic name, of course, because it was the reverse of free. And he stocked it with very cosmopolitan officials. He hired himself, and he was called the King Sovereign. In other words, he was King of Belgium, a constitutional monarch, but he was sovereign and complete, all-powerful sovereign in the Congo.
He ruled with terror in the Congo. Can you give us some examples of how he treated the people from that part of Africa?
Well, the people at the beginning couldn't believe the stories about what the abuses. They seemed to be horrifying. People thought they were just smear stories against Leopold. And gradually, when the British consul, Roger Casement, was sent there and gave an official report to the British government, and this was published, became clear that the truth was even more horrifying than many of the stories. And give you an example, the soldiers, who were actually Congolese soldiers commissioned by Leopold's state, would be sent out to force the villagers to collect wild rubber. Rubber was the most important export from the Congo, used for the new the new age of car tires and pneumatic tires, which was, of course, the world demand for rubber was absolutely zooming up. And this was wild rubber collected in the jungle from creepers, the rubber creeper. Anyway, the unfortunate villagers would be forced to collect a quota in baskets every day. If they didn't collect their quota, they would be beaten up. And if they couldn't collect their quota for some reason, some of them might be shot. And the soldiers would be given bullets for their rifles. And to show they hadn't wasted the bullets, they'd bring back the hand cut off, well what we hope was a dead Congolese villager, and they would bring back these piles of hands to show they hadn't wasted the ammunition. But, I mean, they were absolutely disgusting things they did, mutilations and tortures, and they terrorised a large area of the Congo, the rubber-gathering areas.
Did Leopold have a phony cover story to make it seem like he was a good guy doing good in Africa?
He set himself up as a philanthropist, and it was very hard to persuade people he wasn't, because there was no way they could investigate it. You see, there was no government, no European government they could apply to and say, look, these horrible things have been done in the Congo. There was no minister for the colonies, as there was in British colonies or French colonies or even German colonies. There was no parliament where the atrocities could be discussed, because it was nothing to do with the Belgium state. You see, it was an extraordinary anomaly.
Well, control of the Congo basically eventually passed from Leopold to the Belgium state.
Yes, that was the conclusion of the reformers, the various men who formed an alliance starting in England and then spreading out with, in due course, Belgium allies and also, very importantly, some allies in America, mainly missionaries. They decided the only way of getting the Congo away from the king was to force him to hand it over to the Belgium state, because that was the only way that it wouldn't seem an anti-Belgium move, and it would not, in other words, be a plot by the Anglo-Saxons or anyone else to take away a plum asset from Belgium. It was going to be handed over to Belgium. And it took them nearly, from 1902 when the campaign began to 1909 when Leopold finally caved in and signed it away. So it was a tremendous struggle.
When the Congo switched hands from King Leopold to Belgium, did conditions improve for people in the Congo?
Oh, yes, slowly it improved. But the Belgians did try and run it in an honourable way, but a very paternalistic way, do you see? What they didn't understand was that it would one day be independent, and therefore they must gradually educate the Congolese to be able to take over and run their own country.
Why did Belgium leave the Congo in, was it 1960?
Why did they scuttle out so quickly, you mean? Why did all powers were leaving in 19... you see, the sequence of events, if we're talking about decolonization, the sequence of events was the British left India in 1947, which was more than half the British Empire in terms of people, and of course had been colonized since the 17th century. So the British were leaving the main part of their own empire. It was obvious, therefore, in due course, the British would leave their African empire in due course at some time. Momentum began from 47, when the British left India. By 57, the British were leaving Ghana. That was their first colony they decolonized, first black colony they decolonized in 57. And then Ghana set up a chain of events. And you see, by 60, the French had decided to decolonize all their colonies in Africa. And the Belgians became quite panicky about their ability to control the Congo. And, of course, there was a great war going on in the north of Africa between the French and the Algerians. So for all those reasons, the Belgians felt they had to get out. But they scuttled out in the most undignified way, with disastrous results. In other words, they were quite ill-prepared themselves, and they left the country without proper rulers. And it's been in a mess ever since, in fact.
What do you mean they scuttled out too quickly? What do you think they should have done when they pulled out?
Well, they should have prepared the country with University graduates, how can you run a country without skilled people? There wasn't a single officer in the army in Congo. Congo's, what, population of 60, 70 million now. You can't have an army with no officers, can you? I mean, it was ludicrously ill-prepared. They didn't have universities. They'd only created a university very short time before independence. They wouldn't allow Africans to go to Europe to be educated, in complete contrast with other European powers. The reason apparently was they thought they would bring back democratic ideas which would pass like a kind of infection through the country. They're probably right.
So they prevented people from getting an education and from getting skills and then pulled out. So you
That's
had
right.
people who were uneducated and unskilled having and to figure out how to run a country. So, I mean, you're really putting the blame, of course, at the feet of the colonialists.
Yes. I think it's an extreme case. In other words, you asked me about the Congo and Zaire, how they compared, why it played such a large part in my book. Well, the fact is it was the extreme case when the Europeans came in, when they took over the continent. It was the extreme case when they left it. The worst things happened in the Congo at both ends, scramble in and scramble out.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Thomas Pakenham. His new book is called The Scramble for Africa. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Thomas Pakenham is my guest. He's written several books about Africa. His new book is called The Scramble for Africa, and it's about the European colonialization of the continent. Well, after the European powers pulled out of Africa, there were still a lot of Western interests in Africa, the period that we've called neocolonialism. And if we look at Zaire today, Mobutu has been the ruler since, what, 1965? And I think he's considered to be one of the five richest men in the world, but inflation in his country is something like 2,000 to 3,000%. But hasn't he been propped up by the Western powers?
Oh yes, it suited the West to keep one ruler, whatever his credentials, however undemocratic, provided he was cooperating with their own business and strategic interests. And the fact is, the West, I think, when we look back, we'll all be sickened by the way in the 60s and 70s, after independence, and 80s, the West was collaborating with one-party rulers, undemocratic, very often dictators, military dictators. We were collaborating with them, the West was, and America too, because of the, and we justify this not only in terms of our own standard of living and our own economic interests, but because of the Cold War. Now, with the Cold War over, America, the paramount power in the world, we're surely going to see less interest in Africa. I'm afraid this isn't necessarily a good forecast. We're going to see Africa marginalized. This is one of the big dangers of the moment, isn't it? We'll see less aid projects. But will we see multi-party rule? Will the West take steps to say that aid will be conditional on putting their house in order in these independent African states? I don't know. Nobody knows, do they, present?
There's an interesting story in your family about a link that you had with colonialism. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, you mean about Joe Chamberlain?
Yes.
And the Chamberlain family?
Yeah.
Yes, that's rather amusing, because it's my first political memory, actually. My great-grandfather was called Chamberlain, and he was the brother of the famous Joe Chamberlain, who was colonial secretary and, didn't become British Prime Minister, but had changed sides from the Liberals to join the Tories. He became the leader of the imperial lobby in England, And the second part of my book is a lot about Chamberlain. Now, from our family point of view, he was a rotter because he'd changed sides, left the Liberals. My family were radicals. And in due course, Neville Chamberlain, his son, who was British Prime Minister at the beginning of World War II, Neville Chamberlain made the famous Munich Agreement, the appeasement of Hitler. And my very first memory as a child of five in 1938 was of burning this effigy of the wicked Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain on a bonfire because he'd made this deal with Hitler in Munich. And, of course, what gave it particular excitement was we knew he was our cousin, Neville Chamberlain. He was the traitor to the family, and we took particular pleasure in burning him.
So what was it like for you to be writing this book about the colonialization of Africa, knowing that there was even somebody connected to your family who was a part of it?
Well, I say, I hope I've been fair to him. I've tried to be fair to everybody. But I certainly didn't kind of let him off lightly because he was my great... Joe Chamberlain was my great-great-uncle. Yes, I didn't let him off, no.
I'm wondering if there's anything in particular about Africa that you see very differently now, having completed your book, than you saw before. I'm sure there are a lot of things, but if there's any one thing that particularly stands out in your mind when you think about Africa's present or future...
Well, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful about Africa's future, particularly for the reasons I mentioned of the end of the Cold War and Southern Africa, which looked to be have the darkest prospects, now seems to have the best. And there's a very good reason for that. It is much the richest part of Africa, Southern Africa. And the depressing thing is most of Africa is desperately poor. In other words, the original hope that Africa could be redeemed by commerce and Christianity, well, they got some Christianity, they got jolly little commerce, because Africa was much poorer than the European invaders imagined. There really was no crock of gold, no El Dorado in most of the country. So impressions I got travelling round outside Southern Africa, which I say is relatively rich, the impressions were of this all-pervasive poverty. The fact is people live on mealy pap, which is their staple. They're lucky to have that. Whole families live just on a sack of grain for a month. The standard of living is absolutely abjectly low in most parts. And they will remain the poor continent, whatever else happens, long into the next millennium, I'm afraid.
Well, Thomas Pakenham, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thomas Pakenham's new book is The Scramble for Africa. Coming up, world music critic Milo Miles. The plight of the Haitian refugees has inspired world music critic Milo Miles to survey the different styles of Haiti's contemporary pop.
This is a basic starter kit on Haitian music with a batch of bands and their names, so you should grab the proverbial pencil and paper. This isn't an all-encompassing list, but it is representative and features exceptional performers with recent records you still have a chance of finding. Deciding when any so-called modern pop music begins is rather arbitrary, but all current stars in Haiti still venerate Namur Jean-Baptiste, the bandleader who edged traditional merengues into a style known as mini-jazz back in the 50s. Jean-Baptiste stretched rhythms into the long grooves that would dominate later music in his country, and the terse, stabbing figures that jumped from his accordion can be heard in horn charts to this day. A fine CD collection of the Namur Jean-Baptiste Ensemble is now available under the title A Musical Tour of Haiti.
Te fait minuit, yo ferme toute porte, yo mange toute race. Le te fait minuit, yo ferme toute porte, yo mange toute race.
During the 60s, mini jazz mutated into a Haitian version of soul music and proto disco known as compa. Many of the top bands featured flashy batteries of saxes and trumpets, but some of the slyest and most invigorating grooves came from the guitar dominated groups fronted by singer Coupe Cloué. His deep, purring voice has obvious sex appeal, and from the start he has suggested a worldly fellow, wiser and more lasting than those teen idols. A toothsome and generous new overview of Coupe Cloué numbers is called simply L'Essentiel.
Monsieur Fantawessa, ménage la paix dit en fort. La marche dans la rue, mon capable d'un bébé caboulé. Monsieur Fantawessa, ménage la paix dit en fort. La lave marche dans la rue, mon capable d'un bébé caboulé. Maman, ton vieux gamin.
Finally, there is a style convolution beyond compa that doesn't have an established name yet. It is plainly a return to the roots movement, though. Bands like Bukman Experience and Rara Machine trace their sources to voodoo ceremonies and the pre-Easter Rara parades. This irritates some folks since the new breed's music doesn't have all that much to do with such folk sources. But what return to the roots ever does? At any rate, Rara Machine has its debut out called Break Chain. And for the sake of argument, I can say that this new breed pop has some punk parallels that distinguish it from compa. Women singers, ruder distorted guitars, and heavy layers of polypercussion on everything. Whether the young upstart bands elbow aside compa or not, they're proof that Haitian pop remains hungry, active, and forward-looking.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. Namur Jean-Baptiste, A Musical Tour of Haiti, is on the Ansonia label. L'Essentiel by Coupe Cloué is on Mini Records. And Ra Ra Machine's Break the Chain has been released by Shawnee. On December 26th, Ra Ra Machine is scheduled to play a concert for the Haitian refugees being held at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What does it mean when a man puts on women's clothes? Harvard professor Marjorie Garber has been interviewing transvestites, going to drag shows and rock concerts, and reading Shakespeare to figure out why cross-dressing fascinates some and offends others. We'll talk about her new book, Vested Interests, Cross-Dressing and Cultural Anxiety. Also, Stephen Schiff reviews Oliver Stone's new movie, JFK. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. New York Governor Mario Cuomo says that he will not enter the race for the Democratic presidential nomination because of state budget problems. Cuomo said today that he would have liked to travel to New Hampshire and meet the filing deadline for the nation's first presidential primary. The governor has said in the past that his decision would be based on whether he could win agreement in the state legislature on starving the state's budget deficit. The governor accused Republican state legislators of not talking seriously about the problem. And he said that while he considered joining the race later, Democratic National Committee Chairman Ron Brown said that would hurt the party. The foreign ministers of NATO and their former adversaries in the Warsaw Pact sat around a conference table at the alliance's headquarters in Brussels for the first time today to talk about security arrangements for post-Cold War Europe. From London, Michael Goldfarb reports.
This was the first meeting of what is being called the North Atlantic Cooperation Council. Secretary of State James Baker told the group that this was an historic day for the alliance and all of Europe. It was clear that there are differences in what both sides want to see happen. The NATO countries hope the council will help the Eastern Bloc countries convert their military machinery to peaceful use. Many of the former Eastern Bloc countries want NATO to guarantee their security. Russian President Boris Yeltsin sent a letter to the conference saying Russia wanted to join NATO. He added that he did not expect this to happen until the distant future. The group agreed to hold bi-monthly meetings. The next one is scheduled for February. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
The Prime Minister of Yugoslavia has resigned after opposing a new federal budget that emphasized defeat of the breakaway Croatian Republic. Jane Howard of the BBC has more on the story.
The Yugoslav Federal Prime Minister, Mr. Ante Markovic, told reporters that he'd always been an advocate of peace and against war. He said it was quite unacceptable for him to propose a wartime budget which devoted more than 80% to financing the federal army. He said that the economic disaster was deepening, with inflation spiraling out of control, millions of unemployed, a drop in production, and a shortage of goods. There was great poverty among millions of people in the country who were not in the least to blame. He said it would lead to a social explosion of unimaginable proportions. In a reference to the Serb-dominated federal presidency and assembly, Mr. Markovic said there was no proper body to whom to return his mandate. He said he was ready to help to find a solution if it was asked of him, either by legitimate representatives or from abroad.
Jane Howard of the BBC in Belgrade. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 20 points to close at 2,934.48 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. According to Soviet news reports, Boris Yeltsin has taken over the Soviet Foreign Intelligence Service, rounding out his efforts to put the former Central Security Services under Russian control. As the various Soviet republics prepared to meet this weekend concerning their new commonwealth, the Bush administration indicated that it will start granting diplomatic recognition to the Soviet republics. A spokesman for Soviet President Gorbachev says that Gorbachev told German Chancellor Kohl that no matter what he does in the future, it will be aimed at providing assistance to democratic reforms. At the White House today, President Bush's top aides took efforts to show that the president takes the sluggish economy very seriously. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The president's new chief of staff, Samuel Skinner, announced that the White House will now run on a 6-day work week, Although Mr. Bush and many on his staff already work Saturdays, Skinner said these very tough times demand the full attention of the president's aides, and he was formalizing the practice. Also today, Commerce Secretary Robert Mosbacher emphasized that the president's upcoming trip to Asia will reap benefits back home by pushing Japan and other countries to open their markets to American products. Mr. Bush has been stung recently by a falling approval rating and criticism that he hasn't paid enough attention to domestic economic problems. Today, Mosbacher, who will head up the president's re-election campaign, said the economy, business, and trade are now a top priority. I'm Andy Bowers at the White House.
And the Federal Reserve has moved again to spur on the U.S. economy by dropping two key interest rates. The Fed cut by a full percentage point its discount rate, the interest it charges to loan money to banks. Then a few hours later, it added reserves to the nation's banking system, a move designed to lower the federal funds rate. The discount rate is now at its lowest level since November of 1964. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. You don't have to go to a drag show to be exposed to cross-dressing. You can watch MTV, rent the movie Tootsie, or even reminisce about Mary Martin in Peter Pan. Marjorie Garber got interested in the subject through writing about Shakespeare. Remember, in Shakespeare's day, men played all the women's roles. Garber is a professor of English at Harvard, where she directs the Center for Literary and Cultural Studies. She's written a new book called Vested Interests, Cross-Dressing and Cultural Anxiety. I asked her why she thinks cross-dressing provokes such anxiety in others.
One of the reasons that people are anxious about cross-dressing, I think, is because sometimes they feel as if they can't see the gender behind the person, and not knowing makes them anxious. It also makes them excited. There's something extremely exhilarating, in a way, about the confusion and the destabilization involved in looking at transvestites or at people who are cross-dressed in a certain dramatic situation. I think that there's a lot of cultural concern today with what it really means to be a man and what it really means to be a woman, and that cross-dressing brings some of those anxieties and, again, some of those excitements of crossing to the fore.
What are some of the places in pop culture today where you look around and you see some interesting examples of people cross-dressing or gender-bending in other ways?
Well, Madonna is one obvious example in her Express Yourself video, which was redone in the Blonde Ambition tour. She appeared in a man's pinstriped suit, double-breasted. And I think the double-breastedness of the suit itself was a kind of a pun. In the Blonde Ambition show, she also was wearing beneath that, in this wonderful Gautier costume, a brassiere which sticks out from slats cut into the jacket, so that she emblematizes the whole notion of two genders at once, that she really is kind of a walking figure of transvestism and of transvestic power.
Did writing about the history of cross-dressing make you think a lot about how arbitrary the male and female codes of dress are?
Not only arbitrary, but also changing fascinatingly over time. One of the things I found most interesting in my study of fashion was to see how items of dress that we think of quite securely as being either male or female have migrated from one place to another. That silk stockings, for example, began as an item of dress for Henry VIII. High heels were a male item of dress in the 17th century and crossed over into male and female dress, and then women were left with them in the present time.
Don't you wish the males had kept the high heels?
Absolutely, but perhaps they'll come back.
Here's something that always baffles me. There's something that's very culturally subversive about transvestism, you know, cross-dressing. But on the other hand, it's often the transvestites and the transsexuals who seem to have the most gender-stereotyped attitudes of what a woman is. For instance, you know, I always think that men who dress up as women dress a lot more, quote, femininely than I ever did in my life, you know, because they're likely to wear high heels, lots of makeup, things that really are quote, feminine.
I really agree. In fact, it's a point that I try to make very strongly in the book, that transvestites and transsexuals are more interested in and concerned with defining the borderlines of gender and in stating gender as readable categories than are people who don't spend so much time worrying about gender definition in their dressing. That people who want to cross a line are particularly interested in the existence of that line. And so paradoxically, it is in fact to transvestites and transsexuals that we might well go to look at theories about what maleness and femaleness is and looks like.
Yeah, do you ever wonder why men who cross-dress as women want to be the kind of feminine that so many women have given up wanting to be?
Well, several men who do cross-dress as women, and in fact several male-to-female transsexuals, have written about that, or indeed have called me and spoken to me about it. And they give a wide variety of reasons, as you might expect. There's no particular individual reason. In some cases, it's an admiration for what they think of as female culture. In some cases, it's a pleasure in the act of dressing itself. As you said a moment ago, men dressing as women have all the artifice of dressing, the wig, the makeup, the false or padded breasts, very elaborate clothing and so forth, that there's a kind of pleasurable playing with these items, these sometimes detachable parts that go to make up a visible gender identity. And some men who cross-dress get genuine pleasure out of dealing with all those artifacts, with that assemblage of things that culturally signifies a woman or women to them and in many cases to other people as well.
Yeah, I guess what I found is that sometimes with transvestites that it's a kind of pre-feminist sensibility.
That's often said, and I think it's often true. I don't think it's universally true. One of the feminist claims about drag has sometimes been that it is misogynistic, that it is a critique of women, that it's a parody of women, and that transvestites often in imitating perhaps the most stylish women, but in some cases women like the women whom Divine dresses like are dowdy or of the 50s in some extraordinary way, that there is some sense that there's a critique of women rather than an identification with them. Surely there are some transvestite representations that work that way, but many are quite the opposite. Many are extremely admiring impersonations of or illusions of women. One could think, for example, of Jim Bailey, the extraordinary illusionist who does one-man shows, one-person shows, imitating or impersonating or doing an illusion of Betty Davis and Judy Garland, in which, and I went to see him do Judy Garland, and I had seen Judy Garland herself some years ago, and I was really struck both by how extraordinarily close the illusion was, and how moving, how completely not a parody or a caricature or anything like that, but how much a homage to her this was in a way. You could tell that it was not she, but not because you could discern any vestige of maleness in the performer himself. It was a complete, for a moment, illusion.
My guest is Harvard professor Marjorie Garber. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Marjorie Garber, author of the new book, Vested Interests, Cross-Dressing and Cultural Anxiety. I have to ask you, when you, I don't know if you're ever in a position where you're going to a function or whatever, where you have to put on a fancy dress and high heels and stockings, the whole bit. do you feel like you're dressing in drag when you do that?
Sometimes. Depending upon the costume and how comfortable I'm feeling, and how I feel about the whole event. In a way, someone told me the other day that he went to a dinner party in which all the guests were meant to come in bridal attire, This was a high fashion event. I've never been invited to one of these myself. And I said to him, did you go in a dress? And he chuckled and he said, no, he'd gone in a tuxedo, but he should have thought of that. I often have felt when I'm putting on the last little bit of perfume and drop pearl earring and so forth that there is a kind of drag element in that. And that there's a pleasure in that, too. I think that in a way that the pleasure of becoming another person through your dress and putting on a kind of hyperactivity of gender through a certain kind of costume is itself pleasing and also freeing.
Did you try any new things in doing your study on the history of cross-dressing?
Myself?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What'd you try?
Men's shoes. Very heavy and uncomfortable is my verdict, but with a certain kind of terrific stylishness to them. Neckties I've frequently worn not as a regular item of my wardrobe, but for fun. And I noticed in a piece in the New York Times the other day that tells me that these are now high fashion, sexy wear for women, and that I'm to go to Bergdorf Goodman and get myself a whole collection. But men's neckties I have worn with and played with.
You could have my collection from 6 years ago when they were fashionable.
Are they narrow or wide?
They were narrow. I like them narrow.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
What else?
What else have I played with in terms of gender costume?
How about this? What are some of the interesting places that you went to see different approaches to cross-dressing?
Well, Bourbon Street in New Orleans, for example, or various clubs in San Francisco and Jacques in Boston, which is a transvestite nightclub, are one kind of place that I went. A lot of different kinds of theater that a terrific show that I saw in San Francisco, a one-man show about the history of the fool, in which the actor cross-dressed throughout and demonstrated that just about every part of the body was detachable and could be put back on, which was a kind of cross-dressing show. Wonderful amounts of pop culture stuff like rock shows. I absolutely immersed myself in this book with concert footage as well as in going to rock and other kinds of concerts. And that the research for the book was absolutely extraordinarily great fun. It was full of pleasure and surprises. I also found myself going to a production of Peter Pan with three feminist critics and watching Kathy Rigby swing from the guy wires in a very big old theater in San Francisco, trying to decide whether she was really the Peter Pan of the 90s or not.
When you would go to drag shows or go to meet with drag queens, would you dress differently than you normally do to give a sense of being in the know?
Oh, this is such a problem. I've never figured out how to do this right. The basic black has wound up to be the only way to handle this, I think, with, if possible, at least one ornamental piece of leather or non-ornamental piece of leather.
Well, such as?
Oh, a jacket, usually, for choice. I love jackets. I absolutely love jackets. And I have a whole collection. I think that I've always had an interest myself in individual pieces of male attire, not necessarily assembled together in a total package, but worn as a kind of citation or a quotation, just one at a time.
Do you think that we're living in a period where we're relatively liberated from rigid gender definitions?
It depends upon who we are. I think middle-class and upper-middle-class people in the U.S. are to some extent so liberated. It's arguable that upper-class people in the U.S. and in Europe have been liberated in that way for some time. And I think that there's also a large degree of working-class interest in cross-dress and in crossing those boundaries, but I think it's not easy to say who we are. I think that as a culture, the more other borderlines are becoming blurred for us, the more anxious as well as the more excited we become about trying to fix the borderlines of maleness and femaleness. And the more clothing makes it possible to cross over from one to another, the more there's a certain investment in saying, that's mine, that's yours, I'm taking yours.
Marjorie Garber, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marjorie Garber is the author of the new book, Vested Interests, Cross-Dressing and Cultural Anxiety. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Today, the Federal Reserve Board cut its prime interest rate by a full percentage point. That's the lowest since 1964. Democrats in Congress are asking for action to cut the trade surplus with Japan. We'll ask, if you want to buy an American car, do you have to spend much more money than for a comparable Japanese car? The answer is no, and we'll give you some examples. Our series on the Bill of Rights concludes with an essay about the 14th Amendment. Also, a priest from Miami who works with the Haitian community there tells us about conditions in the tent city at the U.S. base in Guantanamo in Cuba, apprehension and fear, and stories about people desperate to leave their homes.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's Christmas time, and film critic Stephen Schiff says this means it's time for director Oliver Stone to do what he often does for the holidays, release the most controversial movie of the year.
Here's what it's like to watch all 3 hours and 15 minutes of JFK. It's like going into a bar. There's a guy there, a little tipsy, but he wants to tell you about his big JFK assassination theory. He bends your ear for a while, but his theory's pretty good. He's got you going. And just when you're beginning to believe, he says, "And now let me tell you the hidden truth about UFOs." In JFK, as in most of his films, Oliver Stone doesn't know when to quit. Using a jangly, fast-moving combination of archival footage, fake archival footage, and classy detective-style storytelling, Stone shows us how New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison fought to disprove the Warren Commission report. The report that attributed the assassination to a single deranged killer, Lee Harvey Oswald. And finally, a single, fairly deranged bullet ricocheting all over the place. The theory of a lone gunman is pretty easy to refute, and Stone, through Kevin Costner's portrayal of Jim Garrison, does a crackerjack job. But then he also wants us to believe that Kennedy was killed by a gigantic conspiracy involving the CIA, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a squad of anti-Castro Cubans, and even then-Vice President Lyndon Johnson. Furthermore, he tells us that the same conspiratorial octopus was responsible for the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, and that the reason for John Kennedy's murder was that the president was going to end the Cold War and pull us out of Vietnam and do all sorts of other wonderful things that would have displeased the military-industrial complex, and that there's also very little evidence for. It's a lot to swallow. And Stone makes the medicine go down by cheating. On a simple level, he stages scenes like this one, in which Garrison's staff tries to figure out what their boss is telling them.
I'm lost, boss. What are we saying here?
We're saying that when Oswald went to Russia, he was not a real defector. That he was an intelligence agent on some kind of mission for our government and remained one till the day he died. That's what we're saying.
Therefore, because Oswald pulled the trigger, the intelligence community murdered their own commander-in-chief. Is that what you're saying?
I'll go you one better, Bill. Maybe Oswald didn't even pull the trigger. Nitrate tests indicate he hadn't even fired a rifle on November 22nd. And on top of that, they didn't even bother to see if the rifle had been fired that day.
He had his palm print on the weapon.
Well, it went to the FBI, Bill. FBI didn't find a damn thing. It comes back a week later, and one guy in the Dallas Police Department suddenly finds a palm print. For all we know, it could have been taken off Oswald in the morgue. There's no chain of evidence.
I never could figure out why this guy orders a traceable weapon to this post office box when he can go into any store in Texas, give a phony name, and walk out with a rifle which can never be traced.
To frame him, obviously.
Now, as you're hearing Garrison talk about the palm print, you also see, in grainy, real-looking black-and-white footage, a stealthy figure actually putting the dead man's print on the rifle. Sure, you know it's only a movie, but you can't ignore what you've witnessed. Later, when the forces of cover-up argue against it, something in you is buzzing, "Wait a minute, I saw it happen." That's how Stone operates. And he does a lot of other tricky things. In order to make Garrison a hero, he whitewashes the New Orleans DA's frequently shady and even harebrained practices. He distorts facts and creates fictions, and then harangues the audience about the importance of truth. In the movie's worst scene, Garrison delivers an endless, teary courtroom summation in the one assassination conspiracy case he did bring to trial. The summation sledgehammers the same points home yet again for those dimwits who didn't get them the first time. In real life, of course, Garrison didn't even give the summation, and in fact, wasn't in the courtroom at the time. One could spend hours refuting Stone's arguments point by point, not to mention the saggy, cliched scenes in which Garrison's wife, played by Sissy Spacek, whines about how he's neglecting her and the kids, and not to mention Kevin Costner's performance, which is less lackluster than usual, but not by much. And yet, there's one other thing that's worth pointing out, that JFK features some of the most innovative and accomplished movie-making of Stone's career. Like it or not, this dishonest and in many ways hypocritical movie is utterly gripping from beginning to end.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurrock, and Sue Spolin, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with the Spanish film director Pedro Almodovar. In America, he's best known for his films Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown and Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down. His new film, High Heels, is a gender-bending melodrama. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.